This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
And we have a fantastic podcast. It's not fantastic every week, but there's a huge...
Excuse me, I think you'll find it is.
Yeah, but there's such
even more fantastic.
Even more fantastic. This is top fantastic. I've been looking at a broch up on the northwest coast of Scotland, which is just astounding. 2,000-year-old Des Res, it's brilliant. And we have the secrets of the Swedish candy.
And I have been on probably the quietest train I've ever been on in my life.
Which would be a treat for everyone, because they could hear you at the end of the carriage.
Indeed, and they did. Don't make any mistake about it. In spring, earlier this year, a major court decision found in favour of the Loch Lomond National Park. They had argued that lock gates and signs to somewhere called the Drumlean Estate were blocking the public's right to responsible access as granted by the 2003 Land Reform Act. Kenny Auld is an access officer for the Park Authority. Now, Kenny really carried the case, which really could streamline future decisions across Scotland. Recently, he was presented with the Access Achievement Award by the British Horse Society in recognition of his work.
By me?
Was he?
I got to hand over the award.
Well, you live and learn. Ewan heard more from Park Chief Executive Gordon Watson and spoke to Kenny himself, who explained how the whole thing had started.
Well, the community and individuals around Aberfoyle were in touch wanting to enjoy their access rights in an area near Benvenue and around Benvenue and Lockard. And as kind of Access Authority, they let us know and we investigate that to see whether the gates and the signs that they'd raised were indeed barriers to access.
Now, I'm no legal expert, but my understanding of the 2003 Act is that's against the Act, breaking the law, take it down. Is that what you thought?
No, because, I mean, relatively new legislation at that time, access takers and land managers beginning to understand the implications and what their responsibilities were. And when you're on an estate, a lot of estates will have different management techniques, different traditions. Our job is to go in, fully understand the land management of that estate, where we think access rights apply, provide that advice, and also how we think access can be managed on the estate. Because it's not just about where access rights apply, because people want to follow paths, they want to feel confident, they want to have a good day out. So it's not just about having access rights to a boggy field, it's people would prefer a nice path around the boggy field.
But there were also signs up saying, beware of wild boar. Were there any boar there?
Well, there were boar at a time, but our position was that, yes, wild boar were licensed. They could have wild boar there according to Stirling Council and under the Dangerous Wild Animals Act. However, a sign saying wild boar should be on the wild boar enclosure. This was fully electrified. People could be told in advance, this path terminates at a wild boar. You might want to take an alternative route, but you shouldn't really have a sign saying danger wild boar a significant distance away from where the wild boar are.
Gordon, how important was it to take this case on board? Because legally, pretty daunting, because the estate were fighting you.
Yeah, well, obviously that became apparent. We had to take the formal steps of serving access orders to get the gates made accessible again. We thought that was something that we could achieve, but it became pretty apparent that that wasn't going to be the case. And obviously it's been a long haul since then, and in particular the first decision in court went against us. ironically, that was probably a springboard for us to actually, we need to see this all the way, because not only did the decision go against us, but the reasoning for the decision was hugely damaging for how our access rights were being interpreted, because the effect of it was to say access rights didn't apply at all to the estate, and also that if gates were locked before Land Reform Act, they could stay locked. And so those things we felt meant we had to take this all the way and make sure we got the right outcome.
Because potentially it could have massive effects on every farm, every estate in Scotland.
Yes, and we knew a lot of people were watching it, so again, part of our reasoning for continuing to make our case.
So what happened after that? I mean, you made the big decision, financial decision, to go ahead with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, that came after 5-6 years of negotiating it, trying to find compromise. And so there was a long drawn out process of working with the estate, trying to find a non-court solution. In the end, we had to go down that line. It's the only one we've done. We resolve cases like this on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, with landowners working proactively, responsibly with the legislation. So
but you had a hard time even finding out who owned the estate.
Yeah, sometimes that can be harder than you would expect. But once we got there, we tried our best to avoid court process. But in the end, it comes to a point where you have to use your statutory duties because the public were looking, and that we felt the public had a right to responsible access.
Where are we now? Because you won the case, but some of the gates are still there.
Yes, I mean, obviously we had to follow up to make sure that the gates in question that we'd won the case on were passable again. I don't think we would say that they are the prettiest gates in the world, but they are compliant again. Where from there, in terms of, you know, if we can enhance access on that particular estate, it's next to Benvenue, it's quite a popular area, so we'll wait and see.
So you get sent a message out to other landowners, don't mess.
Well, I think I would hope, you know, of all places in national parks is where we're going to take this seriously and where we're getting what is the right outcome. And I think the clarity that it now gives in terms of how to interpret access rights, landowners, what they have to think about, I would hope that clarity is going to benefit all access authorities. And I think we've seen a couple of decisions already draw on the Drumlean case.
Gordon Watson and Kenny Auld there.
Fascinating stuff. I mean, you could argue it was a bit dry legally, but Kenny took 12 years to get that case to
end. How long to find out who actually owned it?
3 years to discover. I think it was a Danish mining company. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. But, you know, hats off them for perseverance. He got a real kicking in the first case, and then they went to appeal court, and he was upheld as being just a great guy. Yeah. And changed the way that they think about the law, which is, as Gordon was saying, big implications for future access cases.
All sorts of people were watching that case for all sorts of reasons. But thankfully, as I've said, it set a precedent and it will streamline any future decisions. Up until the 1990s, Glenfinnan across the west coast of Scotland was principally known for its monument, which stands at the head of Loch Shiel and has a Highlander standing on it. It's not Bonnie Prince Charlie. People think it is, but it isn't. Its railway viaduct on the Fort William to Malaga line also attracted its fair share of visitors too. But then along came
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, and the place went nuts. Now, it's incredibly popular nowadays. As would be expected, parking in the area is, to put it mildly, at a premium. But hopefully next year it could be alleviated to a certain extent. Emily Bryce is operations manager for the National Trust in the area, and Duncan Gibson is chairman of the Glenfinnan Community Council.
Well, it actually got to the point that local people and business owners couldn't go about their daily work. People were basically abandoning their cars on the side of the small road coming into the lower part of the village. And after that, they were actually starting to abandon them on the main 8830, which is the main trunk road, which has got a lot of heavy traffic coming through it as well. So it's been progressively getting worse.
2 months ago, I was heading along this road, heading for Ardnamurchan. It's been a year or so since I've actually seen it in full flight. I assumed there'd been an accident. Queues of cars waiting to get into the car park that exists at the moment, but it was doubled and it's absolutely everywhere. And if you don't put up little posts or rocks or anything like that, people will park anywhere.
No, that's correct. I mean, we had a very unfortunate situation here which prompted us to speak to the Highland Council to put the little posts up. There was an accident in the lower part of the village and the ambulance couldn't get through. again, people don't realise that there's a village beyond that little road. They just think it's just a little country road going nowhere. Fortunately, there was no serious repercussions with the person that had got the injury. But it was very frustrating for the ambulance people. They couldn't get down to get the person out to hospital.
Emily Bryce runs the National Trust for Scotland Visitor Centre at Glenfinnan, and essentially it's the monument in front of you, but you've got the railway behind you. It is becoming hugely popular, and actually that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fantastic thing that recognition for just how special an area this is worldwide now. And I think maybe the speed in which the growth in number of people has come. I mean, we've had 50% more visitors this year than last year. It's just something that it takes a while to kind of catch up, to get the infrastructure to manage that. And in the meantime, it causes these problems and it causes some challenges, but it's not to say we don't want to welcome people, and that's where I think it's fantastic. We at the National Trust for Scotland are investing in our facilities this winter to be able to accommodate more people, but also have a safer system of entry around it. And we're really keen to work with the community on the expansion of further car parking facilities. I think the other thing that I'd like to say is we've got this fantastic West Highland Line railway, which has a station at Glenfinnan, and it would be great to think that we could give people all the different alternative ways of getting here, and coming on the train is fantastic too.
Where are you going to put the new car park?
So it's actually Glenfinnan Estate that has freed up a piece of land for the community benefit. There is already an opening there, so we're just going to be making that fit for purpose to access it. So in effect, it's going to be the entrance to the National Trust car park as it is at the moment. Once that's full, then they can go on to the next one, which is literally almost beside it. There is a sort of river that kind of divides the two, or a drainage ditch, if you like, that divides the two. But what our plan is to keep the pedestrians off of the 8830 is they drive into the car park. I believe there's going to be a link between the National Trust car park for pedestrians to the other car park. And our end goal is, with the landowner's permission, which we have, and he's all for this, is for the pedestrians to walk towards the viaduct, and we're going to get a bridge built to go across the river, which will then link up to the other scenic footpath, which takes you up the hill to get the panoramic views of the train coming across. Yeah. So it's a win-win for everybody. You know, I mean, we're really pleased this has gone through. We have been pushing it for quite some time. There's been a lot of paperwork to do, and it's now paying off, and for the benefit of all the tourists.
2 or 3 years ago, I think it must have been, I mean, I remember trying to get the same photograph, the photograph that everybody wants, you know, of this thing going puff, 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 puff around the corner, out of the cutting and across the viaduct and things. And I thought I'd be standing there with a dozen people, 20 people or something. There must have been about 100 people up there, plus. You know, it is, and somebody said to me this afternoon, yeah, but the Harry Potter thing will wear off. You're shaking your head. I agree with you.
Yeah. If anything, I mean, we were fortunate enough to be here when they were filming it all those years ago, and it's just growing from strength to strength. And obviously, the Glenfinnan Viaduct is now up there with Loch Ness, Isle of Skye. Mm. It is a destination to come. You don't come to Scotland. Yes, you do get the train buffs that come and like to photograph it, but yeah, I've seen easily 300-400 people on that hillside looking for the train to come across.
See, it's interesting, you mentioned some of them, you know, Edinburgh's obviously a huge hotspot, Skye, mobbed out, yeah. North Coast 500, this location here, etc., and it comes back to the same things time and time again. You need the infrastructure to come in behind to cope with the success you've already got.
Definitely, and I think that's something that the National Trust for Scotland is identifying at some of our properties, not just Glenfinnan, but also places like Culloden, that there's a lot of people coming, a lot of coach tours, there's a growth in cruise visits, and it's all fantastic, but as you say, it needs to have the investment behind it to ensure that we give people a fantastic experience and that they go away thinking the positives, not that they've driven a while and then they can't get to where they want to go.
Duncan Gibson and Emily Bryce. And if you are interested in hearing more about the Glenfinnan area and that famous train trip between Fort William and Mallaig, go to the BBC Sounds app and you'll find another Scotland Outspot podcast on that very thing, which we did back in 2010. And a great trip it was too.
Yeah.
Or the Jacobite steam train.
It's great, but she's highlighting, or they're highlighting a problem, mm-hmm. of Scotland's just getting too popular. The thing is, it was great for you and me. Mm-hmm. And then people started telling the rest that I'm not taking credit for all of this.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that snowballs social media. See, that iconic image of the train at Glenfinnan Viaduct. I mean, who wouldn't want to go and see that?
Yeah, it is true.
Which, if you don't have any infrastructure for it, creates a problem that the Scottish Government, local authorities, are going to have to address. It's all very well said. Come to Scotland, you need the hotels, you need the... Sorry, I'm ranting on.
No, but it's a fact.
Toilets.
You know, the success is a wonderful thing, but you have to build on that success and you have to put the infrastructure in behind it. And certainly local and regional councils are finding that increasingly difficult with, you know, the shortage of money that they have, which means that communities and businesses are having to step in and take up the slack. Nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it needs to be done. You can't just ignore the problem. It won't go away.
You're listening to The Morning Rant from the BBC Scotland in the car park with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElroy.
Last week, we did stuff from Montrose Air Station, and we covered, because we were talking about the sort of obviously the centenary of the end of World War One. We covered everything: Airedale Terriers working on the front line, to the infamous McConaughey's M and V stew. That's meat and vegetables. It was a staple during the First World War. It had in it haricot beans, and it was widely rumoured to cause terrible, terrible flatulence.
Yes, now, you're listening to the repeat.
Nice one, good one. Right. Yeah, anyway, you recreated it. You actually cooked some McConaughey's stew.
Yeah, I got the corned beef, I got the beans, I got the vegetables, and it was remarkably edible.
It was very, very tasty, but, I can't speak for the production team. I wouldn't dare to speak for Fiona and Laura, but it lived up to its reputation in my experience.
You drove down the A9 with the windows open.
Yes, never mind. Anyway, we had so much in the, you know, the programme last week, we didn't have time to fit in everything. One of the things I did was I went to Blairnathal Estate in Perthshire. Now, it's a big estate, a classic Highland estate, and what I wanted to know was, during the First World War, what happened there? You know, when all the men went away, what was the implication for something like that? Karen Guthrie is the Blair Castle archivist.
This is a photograph album that's been made for when the castle was a convalescence home.
Do you mind if I look through?
No, of course not. Help yourself.
Wow. Right, big collection of people sitting here on the steps. Now, you can see some of the nurses wearing white. There are two at the front wearing darker colours, and then you've got the convalescent patients surrounding them. Who's that in the middle?
The lady in the middle is Duchess Kitty, and she was the 8th Duchess, and she actually set up the convalescence home. She was a very strong woman.
She looks it. You wouldn't argue with it?
No, you definitely wouldn't argue with Duchess Kitty. She ran the estate when the Duke was off fighting at Gallipoli. There's also a drawing here by Edith Urquhart, who was actually one of the nurses at the hospital, but she was also quite an accomplished artist. And we have several of her paintings in the castle, and she shows us a painting of the ballroom as it would have been with the 30 convalescence beds in it.
This picture is actually very simple. It's basically just a pencil drawing, and they've coloured in the sleeves of blue, and you can see the red cross on the chest of the uniform of the nurse. There's a little card here, embroidery, far from you, but thinking of you. Letters attached, this little lace handkerchief, a wonderfully... What does it say?
It says a souvenir from France.
Souvenir from France, yeah. Somebody's drawn out the Scots Guard cap badge. You know, a wonderfully rakish-looking picture here of the Major. What effect did it have on staffing of the estate?
It was quite dramatic. A large number of men from the estate went off to fight in World War One. In one of the letters, the Duke actually notes that Scott, the second chauffeur, the stable helper, Peter Stewart, who was a head keeper, so quite an important guy, 5 of the keepers, 5 of the hill ponies, Highland ponies, they were all went off to war. The women of the estate who remained behind, they actually stepped in to fill the roles that the men had on the estate.
But that can't have been easy, because if they'd taken the horses off the estate, and presumably it wasn't just the hill ponies, it would have been any type of horse that was useful. That was the muscle, that was the power plant.
Yes, the Duke said they only left 2 broken down nags. But however they did do it. I mean, the gardens, they remained as the gardeners. They grew vegetables and fruit, which were essential. They were clerks in the estate office. And they also worked assisting the foresters, the Newfoundland foresters that came over to fell timber at Craigvenan, at Dunkeld and other areas on the estate. So they were essential, the women, to keep the estate running. There would have been quite a culture shock. But with Duchess Kitty at the helm, I think basically strong women took the strong women of Atholl and led them through.
What impact did it have on the immediate family?
Three of the seventh Duke's sons actually went off to war themselves. So James, who was more commonly known as Hamish, he served with the Cameron Highlanders and he was wounded in France in 1914 and he recovered, but he was captured and he actually remained a POW for the rest of the war. There was Bardi, who went on to become the 8th Duke. He commanded the Scottish Horse Regiment and they fought at Gallipoli. They did lose Lord George Stuart Murray, that's their son, and you can see his death penny here. They were cast in bronze and they were given to the family or the next of kin of the people who had died. Lord George served with the Black Watch and he had fought in the Battle of Aine. Initially he was posted as injured and actually his brother James Hamish, who was there, he went looking for him through the field hospitals. Wounded himself, he eventually had to give up because his wound had gone septic and left. And there was a lot of confusion over whether Lord George had actually been killed or not. There was a variety of reports that he'd been seen stretchered off. But eventually he was listed missing on the 14th of September 1914 and his body was never recovered. Mm. So it affected the family on the estate, but it also affected the people who worked on the estate. Here we have a death penny that was given to Andrew Campbell's family. And actually, the Campbell family had been on the estate for some time. Archie was a woodsman and his wife Jessie. So they had five children and three of the boys went off to war. Duncan, and we can see his medals here.
Sapper D. Campbell, Duncan Campbell, Royal Engineers.
That's right. He received the Distinguished Conduct Medal and he was returned from the war and carried on his job as postman. Andrew, who did unfortunately die, he was a gardener on the estate before he went up and enlisted, and he was killed in the Battle of the Somme.
These medals are contained in little brown envelopes, you know, and Andrew's contains a Black Watch cap badge, Scottish Horse collar badge, British War Medal 1914-18, and the Victory Medal. Now, just about everybody got the last two. How has the archive got these?
A family member handed them in. We have John here, John Campbell, who actually began working on the estate prior to going enlisting in 1914. We know this because we can look through our wages book and see him there. He joined the British Expeditionary Force.
So one of the early ones.
Yes, and when he returned to the estate, he spent the rest of his life here as a woods manager.
You're an archivist.
Yes.
But interesting to hear your speculations on this. When the family hands that in, they want it kept, they want it remembered. Why? Why do we do that?
I don't know. Is it because you don't want your family to be forgotten or the fact that what they gave to the war, they don't want that to be forgotten? And they're worried that if it stays in the family hands, it gets passed down, ribbons get lost or replaced. But if it stays with us in the archives, it stays safe and whole and a memory.
Karen Guthrie, archivist at Blair Athol Castle. You know, one of the joys about doing what we do is what you might describe as privileged access. And Blair Castle's shut at the moment, you know, sort of. They're off season, so everything's getting cleaned and tidied, and they're taking it off the walls and sorting it out, things like that. And she says, oh, do you want to have a look round?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Two fascinating stuff.
I just reversed the car up to the door.
Well, yeah, solely tempted. Tell you what she did do. She brought out a little cardboard box, and inside the cardboard box, you would think there were Christmas decorations. There were like blue glass balls with a circular opening at the top. Any idea what they were for?
Well, I was going to say decorations, but with no light in them?
No.
Funnily
enough,
hang on. How big were they?
About that size.
Did you stuff them full of feathers and they were targets
you
for
did.
Muskets?
Well, not necessarily muskets, but I mean, certainly it was the original clay pigeons.
Yeah, they loved
you stuffed them full of feathers and somebody was given the job of throwing these into the air and you shot them with your shotgun out of the sky and the feathers blew all over the place.
Well done, you.
Well, exactly. Well done, everybody. We, as you know, are keen on the occasional bronc here on Out of Doors. We have seen quite a few in our times. It was a particularly fine example when we were doing the North Coast 500.
Yeah. Go and describe a bronc for those worldwide who don't know what they are.
If you imagine a chimney pot built out of stone, anything up to about 10, 15 metres in diameter at the bottom, and it's basically, it tends to be about twice the height that it is wide at the base, and it would have been roofed over once upon a time. There are some very good examples of remnants in Scotland, some very big examples of remnants in Scotland, but yep. You know, they're unusual structures.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw one up in the Ascent coastline, up in the northwest, on an excavation site at a broch at Clachtoll. The local community decided to find out more about the broch, and their work has given some real insight into life 2,000 years ago. Gordon Slight is the chairman of Historic Ascent.
You're looking at the remains of a 15-metre-high circular tower perched on the coast of Ascent.
And this is a broch of which there are many scattered all over Scotland.
Yes, there are several hundred, mainly in the north of Scotland, but with a scattering of a few down further south.
So when did they date from?
They're virtually all dated in origin perhaps 300 to 400 BC, and then they come to an end at various points after that.
So we're talking 2,000 years and more.
Yes, indeed.
And we're at a site, beautiful site in Clachtoll, anybody knows it, fantastic beach. The waves are pounding into the bay here. This is a dramatic location.
Yes, a very dramatic location, almost certainly deliberately chosen for the drama. Partly to do with the way it looks. It serves other purposes as well. It's on the coast, so you can see it. If you want to trade with people, then they need to know you're there, so that's a useful purpose. You've got a good beach if people want to land. But equally, if they're coming to cause trouble, you can see them coming. They've got to sail into the bay, land over there, and walk all the way along here.
See, I thought it was chosen because of the availability of stones.
There's that as well. The stones are available, particularly on the far side, but you've also got good farmland.
Tell me the story about this broch, because you're working hard at it at the moment to keep it upright.
Yes. It fell down about 2,000 years ago. But the weight of the stone inside the walls has gradually been pushing them out, and so probably been little collapses on and off over the intervening 2,000 years, and it was becoming dangerous and in danger of quite severe collapse in recent years.
Well, let's go up here a wee bit. There's still, I don't know, is that 10, 12, 15 feet high left?
Yeah, the wall on the left-hand side, the landward side, is about 5 metres high. Disappears but down below the rubble, and we assume it went up another 10 metres beyond that, so getting on for 15 metres tall.
So there was a real danger you might lose it.
Yes, yeah, very definite.
So you've got a team of voluntary archaeologists and a professional archaeologist working at the moment. What are you looking for?
First of all, we wanted just to conserve it and ensure that it didn't collapse any further and make it safe for those who were visiting. But also, we hope to discover as much as possible about the people who lived here, how they lived, how they used the broch, and everything that we conceivably could.
Right, we're going to go up here. I'm going to take my time because, as I say, the guys are excavating this. You're up to your neck in mud, sir.
Yes, very much so. It's a pretty wet place.
This isn't glamorous, is it?
It's not glamorous at all.
Why do you want to do it?
Well, I love this part of the country. I'm happiest here, actually. I used to work in IT, that's why I like it.
Right, we're not going up towards the broch. We've also got Leanne, who's working here. You're also covered in mud as well. You're doing the professional bit here.
I am, yes.
What's it like working here?
It's amazing. Yeah, it's an amazing sight and really lovely volunteers as well.
You get paid to say that. Right, we're going to go into the entrance here.
Yeah, and a separate sort of porch entrance. The main broch entrance itself is a good height and you'd be able to walk under that without any difficulty.
So is that defensive then?
Yes, in the sense that you could defend yourself by locking yourself inside, but you couldn't really withstand a siege very easily. but we assume that the only thing they would be defending themselves against would be cattle raiders or something like that.
Right, we've got to go in. And we've got these amazing hollow walls. What's going on down there?
Well, you go down five steps, plunging down to the bedrock, and originally you'd have been able to walk round a corridor and come up on the other side and then go up to the first floor. But we think there have been some collapses in this walling along here, and so they blocked it up and changed it into three chambers instead.
It's still remarkably well preserved, though, isn't it? Because we're coming out into the inside. It's a really rocky floor. You know, there's flat bits out there. Let's get out the window a wee bit. It's a very exposed site, even if it was for aesthetic reasons.
It's a very exposed site, and it's at one level, it's a ridiculous piece of rock to try and build on, because you've got these massive steps going down, very ragged, and a difference of 3 to 4 metres between the outer wall. Whatever was in the minds of the people who built it, that I think they were wanting to demonstrate their power, their influence, their cleverness in being able to build on this impossible site, because you certainly wouldn't choose it from a point of view of ease.
So would this have been farmers, wealthy families, chieftains?
Yes. We think that they are farmers. There are quite a lot of Iron Age sites around this stretch of coast. Quite a few of them are impressive, none quite as big as this. But nevertheless, we don't think this is somebody who has control over a large area. He's just Mr. Big in this local area.
This is a big statement.
Yes. And it's not just Mr. Big, it's him and his whole family.
So it's all the little bigs.
We're really important, yeah.
There's something that's always amazed me is the quality of the building. I mean, if you imagine a dry stone dike, it's clever. But this is 50-odd feet high with massive bits of stone. Would a wealthy landowner or his minions have had the skill set to make this? Or was this the possibility, actually, these were guys that came round and said, do you want me to build you a brock?
I think the latter. There were almost certainly people who were skilled. Whether they brought their own labour force with them, I think, is another question. I would suspect that's unlikely. It's much more likely that the labour was the local families.
So it was a master craftsman.
And a master craftsman or a group of people who had the expertise in how to actually do it and how to take up 15-metre high dry stone walling is not easy.
Is this safe now, or have you saved it?
Yes, we hope we have. We think it's as safe now as we can possibly make it. We've secured all the areas that were causing problems before, and so it is now more stable than it's been for a very long time.
You know what I love about this? It's a wild day, it's a blustery day, it's dramatic in the extreme. Yeah. We have this 2,000-year-old piece of important Scottish history, and there's no gate. There's nobody saying you need a ticket. Nope. Nobody saying you have to join for a year. This is just, it just
open.
Is.
Open, and that was part of the intention in the first place, that it always was open, and our hope locally was that it would be able to remain open. We don't want to have gates and admission tickets.
Gordon Slight, Chairman of Historic Ascent at the homestead of Mr. Big, Mrs. Big and all the little baby Bigs.
I didn't know that there was a suggestion it was... The 2,000-year-old architect went round and said to the local big chiefs, I'll build you a brock, mate. A big prestigious house. I just assumed that local people built themselves. But then you say, well, why are they all so identical?
Yeah,
they're all working to a pattern.
Well, it's interesting because the if you look at cathedral building in the Middle Ages, exactly the same thing. There were roving teams of masons, you know, and it was very much sort of... closed environment. The knowledge they had was so rare, it was so unique, it was passed on within very, very tight confines. Tower houses in Scotland, exactly the same thing. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the tower houses in Scotland were largely built by French masons. So, you know, that concept's been around for a long, long time.
But what I do like, you know, we're on a ranty programme this morning.
Oh, yeah.
That's the way Scotland should... It should all be open.
Yeah.
Don't fence it in. Mm-hmm. Don't charge admission. Yeah. Make it free for all. If you want,
give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above.
Yeah, but if you have a family of four, it's an expensive game touring in Scotland.
If you live in the Inverclyde area, you'll know what I'm talking about here. Something called the Greenock Cut. Now, it's a very clever aqueduct system used for getting water into the town at its industrial height. Mike Holcomb, head ranger at the Greenock Cut Visitor Centre, gave me some background.
What we're looking at here is a really orange sediment coming out of the rocks, and we think it's iron.
It's almost like plastic or plasticine, but it's a really quite bright orange colour.
It's just a tiny wee burn. It's almost like a field drain that's coming
out. It is, yeah, it is. It's a field drain coming off the side of Dunrod Hill, and it is incredibly fine sediment. And one of the things we get the children to do is to sort of stick their finger into it, and it's a very, very small, fine grains, and the kids sort of end up with orange skin.
I'm just doing it even as we speak, and sure enough, it's finer than talcum powder, and by Jove, it does stain the fingers.
It does stain the fingers.
Thanks for that. That's really useful. So what's this we're heading towards?
So we're heading towards the very first sluice gate on the Greenock Cut, and this is where they controlled the amount of water that went into the aqueduct system at any one time. The Greenock Cut is an aqueduct system that was built in the 19th century designed by a chap called Robert Tom, and it was designed as a way of getting water from the hills of Inverclyde into the town of Greenock.
Where we're standing at the moment is a curious mix between Victorian industrial architecture and a fairy glen. It's quite a nice wee location. It is tree-lined. You're in a natural gully anyway. You get the feeling that the loch is being held back on that side. There's a brick cutting down here. There's another spillway, presumably from the loch.
Yes, that's the water that goes from the compensation reservoir into the Kipburn. So it's a man-made waterfall. It's possibly the most photographed waterfall in Inverclyde. On very windy days, you'll actually get the spray from that waterfall blown right back up onto the road, and folks stand up on the road getting soaked.
When you think about the engineering behind this, it's got to be incredibly precise.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember, is it the Roman aqueducts? It was something like it dropped 10 inches in every mile. Mm-hmm. This would probably be slightly more than that, but essentially what you're doing is you're trying to gather all the water from the surrounding hills, channel it in such a way that it goes down to Greenock, and then at the top of the hill, you can control how much power goes down that run.
Yeah, the problem in Inverclyde was that the way the hills lie, there's actually not a lot of way of getting water from the north side of the hills actually into Greenock. Yeah. And so what the Greenock Cut does is it catches the water in this natural water basin that we've got here. And Robert's Tom's solution was to actually move the water. Instead of running from here west to the Clyde, he's diverted all the way around the hills to go north into the Clyde. It's hard to believe that it was done with picks and shovels. We have the children coming up here today, and you have to explain to them there's no JCBs, there's no laser pointers, there's no GPS. This was all maths, engineering, skill, hard work.
Some of this is brick-lined. All of it, however, what did you call that stuff that you... It's not slip-lined, but I mean, basically they lined it with clay.
Yeah, they lined it with puddling clay.
Puddling, is it?
And then because the clay is more or less impermeable once it's soaked, it will hold the water into the cut. But they were worried about vermin tunnelling through the clay. So within the clay itself, they've actually got lots of big rocks and stones. And the idea was to stop the vermin boring their way through all the clay.
And as extraordinary as this is as a piece of civil engineering, there was a clear link between this and the slave trade.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate, and a lot of people don't like to think about it, but the water for the Greenock Cut powered the industry of Inverclyde. First and foremost, that was its purpose. The secondary purpose was it got fresh drinking water for the people of Greenock. But those factories that were in Inverclyde, they are linked to slavery. So there was a number of sugar factories in Greenock, the most famous being the Tate and Lyle building, and that was probably the largest of the sugar refineries in Greenock.
It's not a huge height that it comes out above Greenock, something like 200 metres?
Yeah, so it's only about 270 metres or so above Greenock. Like you said, though, the aqueduct systems are incredibly precise. This one has a fall ratio of 1 in 200. Uh-huh. So for every 200 yards it's going forwards, it had a yard drop.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly precise. And it caught an incredible amount of water. The cut goes round the hills, it goes to the north end of Greenock, and then it went into a reservoir in the north of Greenock before it then went into two separate channels. And the separate channels then powered the waterfalls, which then powered the water wheels of the factories. And it wasn't until, I think, 1918 that the last water wheel was used in Greenock. After that, it all moved to hydroelectric.
But the great thing about that, to my mind, is it's the sustainability of that energy. You can have a factory, say it's 270 metres, you can have a factory at 250 metres, and they're using the water. Mm-hmm.
50 metres further downstream, you can have another factory, because the factory is only borrowing the water.
Indeed,
at the top.
Yeah.
So you could have half a dozen factories.
Well, that's
down
it. I think it was the eastern falls of the aqueduct system in Greenock had 19 factories. And that was anything from cotton mills, sugar refineries, rope works, everything, or anything that could be powered by water was.
Do people, the local people, actually know about this? Is it well known? Because you're so close to Glasgow.
We are. I mean, I would say of all our visitors, the majority of them are local people from within Inverclyde. Obviously Glasgow as well, being only 50 or so minutes away from the city centre. And a lot of people don't call us the Greenock Cut. To a lot of people, this is the cut. It's not an uncommon term to say, I'm going up the cut. And it's quite funny because you read the history of the cut, and it wasn't long after the cut was completed that this became a tourist attraction and a way for people to enter the countryside. People were walking the Greenock Cut to access the hills and the moorlands of Inverclyde back in the 1820s. So not a lot's changed, really.
We've talked about the cut, we've talked about the reservoir immediately beside the cut centre, but there are lots of little lochs and reservoirs that, as Greenock grew, the necessity for fresh water grew, they kept on building more and more.
They did, yeah.
And there's paths all over this area.
There is, yeah. I mean, I suppose it's the same with the rest of Scotland, is that we don't have maps of right of way like you do in England. But once you know the area, you do realise there's paths zigzagging all over the place up here, and they are really well used by people.
Mike Holcomb at the Greenock Cut there, and apparently when that was opened way back when, the local provost of Greenock actually went round it in a little gondola. I want to do that.
I would love to see you in a gondola.
Yeah.
Is it burned out at sea?
No. Well, you're confusing umpteen different cultures, and not for the first time.
But it's a lovely image.
Yeah, you're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElriff.
Yeah, you can catch up anytime you want, but go to the BBC Sounds app or go to our BBC Radio Scotland website. But you probably know that because you're listening to this in the first place.
Indeed. We do like hearing where you listen to the programme and some of the stories behind that. Dr. Doug Stewart got in contact with us to say, I emailed you in March this year to say that following a stroke, which left me unable to walk, part of my rehab included lying in bed listening to your podcasts. I especially enjoyed the bits about hill walking, which allowed me to visualise myself exploring the hills of Perthshire above Blairgowrie, where I was brought up. And he goes on.
Yeah, my rehab is going well, and I'm delighted. Well, we're delighted as well. Delighted to say last weekend, I was able to make the journey from Leicestershire, where I live, back to Perthshire with the help of my lovely wife, Ali, and walk 3 miles of the Cattern Trail near Glen Shee. I hope to return next spring to see if we can walk the rest of the trail. Well, so do we. Still a devotee of your programme, which for me played a crucial role as part of my rehab. Dr. Doug Stewart.
Good to hear that, Doug.
That's great.
Crack on.
And good to know we're being issued on behalf of the National Health Service.
Only a matter of time. Now, you were up in the Cabrach area quite recently.
Yeah, well, we've been up there a couple of times recently, because last week we had a bit of a programme on World War One, and that was quite an impact on the Cabrach as well.
Well, what was fascinating about that was it is a very, very remote area in the northeast of Scotland. And when the men came out of the Cabrach and went into these military camps, for the first time in their lives, they were exposed to diseases like measles, and their immune system simply couldn't cope. Many of them died long before they got anywhere near the front line.
Yeah, and if you are in Scotland travelling around, you know, it's not the immediate destination you would think of, but the Cabrach in, up in Aberdeenshire, it is wild, and there's croft after farm after croft after farm deserted purely as a result of that. But if you fast forward to the Cold War, nuclear bunkers or posts, given their proper name, were built right across the country. There's one very near you as we speak. And Post 32 in the Cabrach is coming back to life. Peter By Jensen is the heritage manager of the Cabrach Trust.
We're on a blasted hillside just above Dufton. Why?
Well, we're here because this is here where the nuclear monitoring post is. And this is where we're going to build a heritage centre.
Because we've got these two pipes sticking out of the ground on a hillside. And this is a special place.
It's a very special place. I mean, the landscape itself is rough, and it's presenting Scotland as its finest when we're talking about rural landscapes.
And what was the point of this bunker?
Well, this bunker...
It's not a bunker, is it?
Well,
it's a post.
No, we call it a post. It's post 32, to be very precise. So the role of this post was to monitor airplanes, first of all, and second, monitoring nuclear downfall in the event of a nuclear bomb going off.
So was this supposed to be secret?
Well, They were secret, but everybody knew about them.
And, I mean, it's quite an exciting thing. I'm going to go down inside it in a minute. As I say, you probably wouldn't have known what it was if there wasn't somebody here to tell you.
No.
A couple of wee bits of concrete sticking 2 feet above the ground, just in the middle of a field.
Well, we plan in the Trust to refurbish the posts as much as we can. It's difficult to get our hands on original paraphernalia, but we're quite confident in slowly piecing together the history of the post with the original and authentic artefacts. It's going to be part of the story that we're wanting to tell. And so that's all from sort of Viking invasion, Picts, Jacobite rising, illicit whiskey smuggling, and historic whiskey distilling. I think the bunker is going to, or the post, is going to be one of the big things that we can show in the landscape, because one of the things that we really want people to see here is, of course, the landscape.
But this is a story that's in danger of being lost.
I think so. And therefore, it's very, very important that whilst there's still people alive remembering how it was to be in these posts, that we get to talk to them. And those are the guys that you've got here today.
It looks pretty tight in there.
Aye. It looks tight from the surface, but actually it's quite nice down there.
Might be nice to get out of the wind, thank you.
Right.
Well, as you can hear, it is blowing a hoolie. I'm just coming up to a little concrete plinth with a hatch. I've raised the hatch and I'm looking way down, about 25 feet down, I think. Just looks like a chimney at the moment. This is where claustrophobia steps in, but we'll give it a go. Into the ladder. This is slightly bizarre. As I said, it's a completely bleak hillside. And this hole in the ground, which we're now descending, rung by rung. It's getting panic levels increasing, rung by rung. And here we are. In a little box underground. And two men in uniform. George?
You and how you doing?
I'm good. And Bill?
Alright.
What is this, George?
One of the 872 nuclear bunkers for the Royal Observer Corps. So these were positioned every 10 to 15 miles apart.
So what did you do?
Our job here was to solely plot a nuclear burst and give warnings to the public.
So if it did go off, if there was a blast, were you stuck down here, were you?
Yes. We would be down here, three of us. There was usually 10 in a post. That gives you three crews of three and a spare man, like, so. 8-hour shifts.
Talk me through what you did here, because, I don't know, it's 10 feet by 15, 20 feet?
That's something like that. Yeah, we're 50 feet down below ground.
Feels like more than that.
I know.
Once we were down here, that was our communication. That's a telephone.
So you would phone Aberdeen, would you?
We could contact Aberdeen with that. And what we had, we were a BPI here, let me let the blast over pressure of the nuclear blast. That was the first thing we would know about a nuclear war. We report that to Aberdeen.
Right. So what would go through your mind at that point? You'd be excited, or you'd say, oh, heck?
We had drills to do, so we knew perfectly well what was
just standard. Okay.
Yeah.
A minute later, you went up and changed the GZI papers to...
So you're going up into the nuclear cloud?
Well, if it was close, yes.
That's a big decision to make.
Yes.
The blast was passed before you went out. You waited a minute before you went outside. And you would have got the GZI papers, which photographed the blast. You'd work out the bearing from that, report that to Aberdeen. Three posts, different bearings, triangulation. That's where the bomb burst. And the blast, they could work the nearest post. Size of the bomb. And
this is a fascinating piece of history that's not a huge amount of people know about.
No, that's correct, because there were about 10,000 of us up to 1991. So each observer carried a dosimeter, which is an individual piece of equipment that tells you how much radiation you've absorbed, and the one with the least radiation was sent upstairs to change the papers. So
this is scary. I'm laughing. It's terrifying.
But then on the desk here, you'll see we've got the fixed survey meter, which was connected to a wire, and it went up that tube, and we can get a reading from outside without going outside how much radiation there was. And again, we've also got one hanging on the wall, which was used for mobile monitoring. So we had to go to Elgin or up the road to the Cabrach, whatever, then we could go and get some information regarding the nuclear burst.
Is that an early warning alarm over there?
Yes, we've got the siren, and we've also got the WB 1400, the carrier receiver, which give a regular tick. And
so does the siren work?
Oh, yes, but it's too noisy in here.
OK. Well, we'll go upstairs and we'll give it a try. We're just back out on the hillside. It is bucketing rain now. It's wild. Is this going to be loud?
Steady note.
George Anthony, a bloke called Bill, and Peter By Jensen.
It was a real eye-opener for me going down there. I'm claustrophobic at the best of times. This is a tiny little hole.
I know.
And deep underground, and the thought of being there, A, they got no contact with their families, and they would be down there for the duration.
Those little, that type of bunker was an observation post, and they were staffed by the Royal Observer Corps. The big command and control bunkers, however, are enormous. They're about the size of football pitches and usually on three floors. There's one in Edinburgh, but there is also one in the corner of a suburban estate in Dundee. And you, for all the world, you'd think it was just an electricity substation. And you walk down and it's massive, absolutely massive.
Yeah, I'm giving my age away here, but I can firmly remember when it was a real threat in the 70s and people did expect the possibility to happen. Lots of people were talking about having shelters in their own gardens. Yeah. I certainly thought about it. And you talk to my children now and they give me that sort of blank look and say, really?
Yeah.
But it was scary times, and you could argue we're still in scary times. But
yes, we're just ignoring the threat nowadays, probably.
On a happier note.
On a happier note. We like trains. You know, who doesn't like trains? Wonderful things, trains. Mostly steam trains, admittedly, but recently I tried one that, of a kind that I'd never been on before. It was courtesy of Viva Rail. They are the UK's smallest and newest train manufacturer. And what makes this train different is how it's powered. That's the sound of a battery-powered train. It's as close to silent as I think I've ever heard. This is one of my favourite places in Scotland. It's the Bowness and Kinneil Steam Railway Preservation Society. Standing beside the engine sheds, and there is a beautiful old steam train there at the moment in blue, white and red livery, steaming up, black smoke coming up into the blue sky. Beautiful. So that's train travel as was. However, at the far end of the platform, there is another train, and I'm standing here with Adrian Shooter from Viva Rail. Why is that different?
Well, it's our very first mainline battery train, and we decided in association with Transport Scotland and ScotRail to launch it here on the Bowness and Kinneil Railway. It's a battery train which has a capability of running up to about 40 miles there and back, charging automatically at each end, doesn't require any electrification, absolutely zero emission. It's a UK product, and this is the first one, and it's available now.
I'm sure this is an incredibly crude description of it, and I apologise for it, but essentially, is that an electric car in train form?
Well, that's one way of describing it, yes. The interesting thing is, battery technology is moving forward in leaps and bounds, and it's all driven by the auto industry, and the rail industry may just as well take advantage of it, and that's what we're doing.
There are two carriages on this train, and there are probably about a couple of hundred people hoping to get on it. I'm one of them.
Stand clear of the doors, stand clear of the doors. The door's about to close.
Very similar to being in an electric car. There's no sound whatsoever. And the train just starts to move.
Neil Bates, Design Director of Viva Rail.
This train was a London Underground surface stock train for a long period of time. It should still be in traffic. It should be on there for another 15 years, but they were retired early and they were available for purchase, so Viva Rail decided it would be a fabulous test bed for its ideas going forward.
And what have you done with them?
We've converted them to run on mainline railway with their own power packs underneath. Originally, they skimmed their power from a third rail. That's not available on the national network, so we manufacture our own electricity on board.
How do you do that?
Initially, we used a diesel engine. We've taken a Ford automotive power pack from a Ford Ranger. That develops a significant amount of power for us. However, the train that we're on today is a battery version. So the power pack, which has the diesel, the same size module, has been replaced with a battery system.
Why did you choose to come to Bowness to actually demonstrate it?
It's a fabulous location, and these trains can run anywhere. So if our train can run here, it can run in a city, it can run into the western parts of Scotland, it can be used for tourists or commuters. It's a perfectly flexible vehicle.
How did you get it up here?
It arrived on a truck.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's an irony that although it's on the railway, it's quite often the easiest way to move trains around quickly is to put them on a truck.
I'm a blogger who is following battery technology, hydrogen technology on trains, and I decided to come up today to see it because I've not ridden on this. I've ridden battery trains before in Essex, and it's a similar sort of experience, you know, reliable and keeps going and everything else like that.
It's like being in an electric train, really, but without the overhead wires, which is really rather marvellous. There's these forests of steel that they've extended around the country. To me, they detract from the scenery and they're horrible.
Why is there a need for a battery train?
Well, anywhere where someone wants a train which is quiet, emission-free, no exhaust whatsoever, it accelerates well, good performance, and of course it doesn't require installation of any electrification equipment.
Which is expensive.
Yes, it is. Now, just to be clear, I've got nothing against, and our company has nothing at all against electrification, which is important if you want fast trains, it's important if you want heavy trains and freight trains and such like, but there are some lines where the case for electrifying is, shall we say, a bit marginal, where a battery train may well be the right solution.
I live in Bowness and I'm here because I thought this was an April Fool, to be honest, to see an underground train actually out on the track in Bowness, so I had to come just to receive my own eyes.
What do you think of it?
I think it's amazing. It's quiet, it's lovely, it's just how nice and clean and up-to-date looking is it? And just to see it, say, above the land, it's just like something else.
Say you get onto your battery-powered train and you travel your 40 miles and, you know, basically the batteries run out at that stage. What do? Do you change all the battery packs? Or do you recharge them? What do you do?
They wouldn't run out. They still have plenty of capacity. We've designed and patented an automatic battery charging station. So the train comes to a stand, no one has to do anything. It couples itself up automatically, tops the charge up in 8 or 10 minutes and then goes back again. It'll do that 18 hours a day.
My name's Ben. I'm from Suffolk, but I live in Glasgow now. I study in Glasgow, but I'm a rail enthusiast, so I came down here because, you know, I loved the D-Stock. I was on the very last D-Stock run in the London Underground and thought I'd never be able to travel on one again. It's been done better than I expected. I think it's very clean. I think the components that have been reused are the right components that have been redone. The seats are very comfortable. They're the original seats. They're not these horrible ironing board seats, which get much criticism in modern trains. I think the handrails and the grab rails and all the physical equipment should have been retained, that has been retained, and it's so smooth, it's so quiet. It's quieter than most new trains. It's fantastic, and passengers love it.
Happy passengers on the battery train, along with Adrian Shooter and Neil Bates of Viva Rail. Now, take that guy's point about the infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, regardless how you look at the ecological benefits of electric trains, all those gantries are an ugly scene on our landscape. And battery, I think, is the... I don't understand why it's not being developed so much, because the early trains in the London Underground were battery, because you couldn't run a steam train, although they did develop the technology later on, but I'm not going to bore you. And there was a battery train ran from Aberdeen up to Ballater for a long time. It charged up in Aberdeen, charged up in Ballater, and back and forward it went. And why you would want to change that for a diesel is beyond me.
Beats me.
But then again, we're not employed for our locomotive knowledge.
aren't we? Comes as news to me, I'm telling you. Probably the highlight of our live programme, we do the radio programme Out of Doors, upon which this podcast is based, this week was the advent of the Swedish candle.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I can't remember how we stumbled upon it, about the concept of a Swedish candle. Now, this isn't tallow, a traditional candle. This one's made out of wood. And I found a video of it, and I thought, we threw it out in the ether, said, anybody know what they are? And frankly, a resounding nothingness.
Zilch.
And anyway, I thought nothing more about it. And I was getting some hardwood up at the firewood supplier up in Huntley in Aberdeenshire. And I was walking along, looking at the wood. And I said, what's that?
It's a Swedish candle.
And the guy gave me a kind of funny look. I said, is that a Swedish candle? And he looked suitably impressed. I said, can I have one? He said, yeah, of course you can. Yeah. So he gave us one. And we set fire to it.
It took a wee while. It took a while to work out how it worked.
I mean, describe it, first of all.
Well, basically, if you imagine taking a log and standing it on its end and then taking a chainsaw, and almost as if you were cutting a birthday cake. You don't cut it all the way down to the ground. You have to leave a bit for the base. And then what you do is you feed in little bits of tinder.
Yeah.
Well, basically, it's just like wood shavings. We cheated. We used some fire lighter and things like that into the centre. Once this thing catches, it goes up like a... Well, it's fantastic. Wonderful thing, to be
honest. Because it vaporises the wood.
Yeah.
And you have a gas stove.
Yeah.
We got some video of it on our Facebook page. Go and have a look at that. It is a wonderful thing to behold. But I thought I'd do a bit of research into the origins of this beast. And it starts amongst the Sami tribes of the high north of Scandinavia. Bente was worried. Her brother had left her on the forest edge at dawn, seeking food and shelter. The pair had lost their parents in the whiteout of an Arctic wind, and now were far from the safety of the family tents, and more crucially, the family fire. They both knew the rules. Never stray. Never, never, never dig in the snow, and we will come to find you, had been the mantra of their parents ever since they could remember. But Alni was 13 and knew better, much better. They ploughed through the snow in the direction he confidently led, until exhausted, hungry, cold and utterly lost, they took shelter behind a fallen tree. The snow piled up against the trunk till it threatened to engulf them. Alni secretly realised he'd put them in danger and decided to act. He gave his last strip of dried reindeer meat to Bente and set off again, leaving Bente behind. But that was 3 hours ago, and in the shortness of the Scandinavian winter's day, darkness descended quickly. Alone, hungry and scared, she prepared for the long night ahead. She pulled her galky coat of fur even closer to her body, the hood of her bright blue and red luka she tightened round her head. It would be cold, it would be dark, but the dress of her forebears had evolved to keep out the vagaries of the storm. She pulled herself into a nook in the branches and hoped for sleep. Sleep that would never come. For in the darkness, echoing across the tundra, came a call she never wanted to hear. It was far away, but it was there. And a wolf can hear prey 6 miles away and sense its scent from a mile and a half. She shivered desperately, trying not to make a sound. The call came ever closer. The wolves at this time of year were hungry, very hungry. Bente sniffed the wind and then relaxed. It was blowing from the pack into her face. She couldn't smell them, but she knew that they couldn't smell her. Keep quiet and the danger would pass. For half an hour it felt that not a breath had been taken, so determined was she to keep that silence. Eventually the calls faded and once more she was alone, or so it seemed. As suddenly Bente sensed a presence that grew and grew and slowly took partial glowing shape by a tree nearby.
Suddenly, a lone call of a wolf once again split the night. The wind had changed, and Benty knew the pack had turned back. The shape took form, till Benty recognised Laib Olmai, the spirit of the forest, the man of Alder, the guardian of the woods. But she was apprehensive. Traditionally, the Alder man protected the hunters, men. It was said to look down on women. But Benty felt deep in her soul that the Laib Olmai meant her no harm, and in fact, had come to her aid. He raised a leaf-clad arm and pointed towards the hills. Through the darkness, another form emerged. Buaza, a female reindeer, hauling an empty sled made of alder. She nodded to the spirits and called the animal closer. As she stepped onto the platform at the rear, the animal took off through the darkened woods at great speed, and once again, the wolf howled. Faster and faster through the night, led by the spirit, till suddenly they came to a standstill by a great rock. Benty descended and followed the spirit into a cleft in the rock, a cleft which became a cave, and still the wolf howled. Even a cave was not a safe haven from a hungry pack of man's most feared animal. There was only one thing which would keep her safe throughout the long night to come. The shape of the Laib Olmai strengthened and left the cave, only to re-emerge carrying a log. The Tiega, the snow forest, is littered with the remains of fallen trees and branches. Tinned or dry, the moisture sucked from the very fibres of the wood by the cold, dry winds of winter. He drew a finger across the wood. Immediately a cut appeared in the log, almost to the very base. Another wipe of a finger, another cut, another, till the wood took the image of the pole star, which dominates the heavens in the northern hemisphere. Some shavings, some dried mushroom dust, a flint, then a spark, then a glow, then a flame, and then the warmth and light of a candle, a very special candle, a candle which is known in Sweden to this day. A candle which burnt for the remainder of the night, throughout the day, and till the following dawn, when Benty heard the calls of Olmi and her mother and father as they searched for their missing girl. High on a cliff, hidden by trees, the man of Alder looked down and smiled.
I have a cunning plan, my lord.
What's that?
Well, first time I heard that, I thought, that's really lovely. What you should do is put those together and turn it into a children's book. Why don't you put together all those There Is A Legend stories, like what you make up, and actually bung it out at Christmas time for children?
We could have a children's...
children's podcast.
Scotland Outdoor Podcast. Yeah. We'll have to produce that. Put that to our senior producer.
Yeah, see what actually happens. Anyway, sadly, yeah, that's all we've got time for.
Entertain
this week.
Your children at Christmas.
Absolutely. Scare the living daylights out of them. Give them matches. See what happens. Sadly, as I say, that's all we've got time for this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. We will be back next week with yet another one. Until then, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.